Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Delighted to be with you on a Wednesday afternoon. Thank you very much for being here with us. We got 2 hours of open forum. It's a little bit of bonus open forum for you today. If you've got a question about the Catholic faith, whether you are Catholic or not, this is your day. 888-318-7884 is the number to call. 888-318-7884. Maybe you want to know about the church or the sacraments. Maybe you want to know about the Bible or the moral teaching of the church. Maybe you want to know about the person of Jesus Christ. Whatever it is, you are welcome to call. 888-318-7884. Our guest is Joe Heschmeyer, apologist at Catholic Answers, author of a number of books, including the new one, The Eucharist is Really Jesus. Joe Heschmeyer, welcome.
Thanks. Good to be on the show.
I slowed down there because I think the last time I said the Eucharist really is
Jesus. Yeah, I could tell. You were starting to say the Eucharist really is Jesus, is really Jesus.
Yeah.
You know, I think if people put it in wrong, they're going to get close enough that Google can figure out what they're looking for.
Yeah, right. Indeed. And a very well-received book and part of kind of it's your work, but all of us at Catholic Answers see it as part of our effort to be helpful in the Eucharistic revival.
Yeah, good job, everybody.
Thanks. Thanks for sharing the credit with us, Joe. 888-318-7884 is the number, 888-31-TRUTH. And you are welcome to call, whether you're Catholic or not. And by the way, if you are not Catholic, sometimes people who are not Catholic, maybe not religious or maybe Christian, fellow Christians who are not Catholic feel like, no, I don't want to, you know, interrupt them. They're doing their Catholic show. That is not how we feel about it at all. It's really good for us to have those other conversations. And you are welcome. 888-318-7884. I'm about to go to phones, Joe. Are you ready
Let's
to go
do
to
it.
The phones?
Let's go to the phones.
Really? You feel ready?
You know what? We got some nasty emails about too much banter. Maybe not nasty.
No, that wasn't
emails.
That wasn't. You might be referring to one email, but the primarily it was the staff who said.
Yeah. I think it was kind of a consensus. Everyone in and out of the building was like, "Stop talking so much.
Stop talking so much, you weirdos. Get on with the show." Okay, let's go to Liam then. Listening in Ohio on the Catholic Answers app. Liam, thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question for Joe Heschmeyer.
Thank you for letting me ask the question. My question is that after I had been confirmed as a Catholic, I became my nephew's godfather in a Lutheran Missouri Synod baptism. What should I do to rectify this problem?
Pray your godson into the church. I mean, that's really like you're not going to like become like an ungodfather. So technically, canon law talks about what to do in terms of Catholic baptism, that the godparent, like there's certain rules for the godparents, including like being a practicing Catholic. But there's no explicit instructions in terms of non-Catholic baptisms because canon law doesn't really govern or regulate that. Now, typically, out of respect for non-Catholic Christian traditions, you'd say, like, if you're not a practicing Lutheran, you probably shouldn't become, like, a godfather to a Lutheran child because you can't really, in good faith, promise to raise them in the Lutheran faith. But since you already are the godfather of the child, and since you believe you have the fullness of Christianity to which Lutheranism is pointing, then it's appropriate, I think, to use that position that you've been entrusted spiritually to really pray for and counsel and help guide this person who has been placed in your care by his or her parents, but also ultimately by God himself. So in all seriousness, when I say like, just pray the child into the church, I mean that fairly seriously.
Okay, Liam?
Okay, thank you. Yeah.
Yeah, you don't need to do anything. I mean, other than that, just be a good godfather to him.
Got it, thank you.
Thank you, Liam. Thank you very much for getting us started. It's open forum today. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. And off we go to, I think this is Louisiana. John in Louisiana listening on the app. John, go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hi, Joe. So I'm going to try to be as brief as I can. My wife and I recently had a baby about 8 months ago. She's So it was through C-section, so pregnancy in the near future is dangerous. My wife and I have been discussing, you know, the contraception. I'm against it. She is nervous for a number of reasons. But so we're, you know, it's starting to put a strain on the relationship. And I guess what it comes down to, she still remains unconvinced about the moral implications of it. So what are my obligations and my moral obligations and duties as a husband if we end up not agreeing?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think one thing that's really important is you want for the health of your marriage and the good of your marriage to be in a gentle kind of role where you're not just domineering. That's not, that might work in the short term, but it'd be really, you know, a bad strategy in terms of both, you know, the love a husband owes his wife, but also just in terms of the kind of pragmatic long-term consequences. So being a good guide rather than trying to be like a marital dictator, it would be the first thing I'd recommend. And second, you're asking something that's really at the heart of an ongoing dispute within the church right now, which is to what extent a Catholic can cooperate with a spouse who isn't on board about contraception. So in terms of male contraceptives, you certainly can't do something like that. You know, you can't use a condom or something where you're actively involved in the contraceptive act. Whether you can continue to have normal marital relations with your wife if she's on, say, birth control, is a disputed kind of question. And so I think there's a good argument to be made based on John Paul II in Familiaris Consortio that you should just try to live as brother and sister unless and until kind of she gets on board, because you'd still be cooperating with the contraceptive act. But there's another school of thought that I think will appoint to Amoris Laetitia and suggests that maybe in this case it would be morally permissible. I lean in the first direction and say, I think it's better to err on the side of caution and just say, let's pause marital relations until we can do it in a spirit where contraception is not involved at all. NFP, I would, I guess the other thing I'd say is, so that's just on one level. In terms of a deeper long-term solution, getting connected with people who can model NFP in a really healthy way to show that it's not as scary and you know, dangerous and everything else as it might seem at first, is probably going to be really important, because you can make every argument in the book, but unless you can point to the example of real lived experience, you know, here are these Catholics who are living this and it's happy and it's, you know, good for their marriage and all of these things, that I think is going to be ultimately more persuasive than just saying, you know, hey, honey, read this papal encyclical. And so I would encourage you kind of in that route to maybe read up on what John Paul II has to say about self-gift, but also to, as much as you can, surround yourself by people who are living that life and can kind of model it in a way that's happy, holy, healthy. But it's a very difficult situation. And then just, you know, be patient with one another, because it's something where anytime husband and wife disagree, that's always difficult, especially on an issue this important, where both of you have really grave concerns about the other person's position, and understandably so.
Yeah, thanks. That's really helpful. And I don't know if you know of, you know, obviously, you know, I've read up on JP2 and all of and the encyclicals and everything, and but I don't know if you know of any reading or anything on from a woman's perspective that's written or that's readily available out there.
So my wife is asking. I've not read it, but Simca Fisher, S-I-M-C-H-A, and then Fisher. Mm-hmm. I think it's F-I-S-H-E-R. There may be a C in there, but I don't remember. She has something called like a Sinner's Guide to Natural Family Planning that's written from a woman's perspective. Mm-hmm. I've never read it, so I can't really give an endorsement one way or the other. But I know that's okay. At least something written kind of in that area. I know Janet Smith also has written some things. I think Contraception, Why Not? And I'm sure there are others, but those are the two that come to mind immediately.
Okay. Thank you, Joe. Very helpful, as always.
Oh, good. Okay. Oh, thank you.
Thank you very much, John. It's open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Your calls welcome, 888-318-7884. We'll take a quick break. Be right back with more Joe on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment. Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
I'm continually amazed and humbled at the way God can work through me to help so many people. Although I have no idea what the caller's questions will be that day, I trust that the Holy Spirit can use my education and experience to guide, challenge, or comfort those who call.
Mast Appeal with Colleen Kelly Mast, Saturday morning, 9 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's open forum today. Your call welcome. 888-318-7884. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. And if you got any question at all about the Catholic faith, you are welcome to call. We're going to start this segment here with Patrick in Fort Eustace, Virginia, listening on the Catholic Answers app. All app calls so far today. Patrick, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. My question is, I was told recently by someone in the Catholic Church that the prayers of, like, say, a father for the children or a mother for a children vary in the amount of their effectiveness or power, and that would extend out to, say, someone's prayers for a friend versus a family member. Can you expound on that or explain that to me?
Yeah, I can. I think we want to make two distinctions. First is just prayers in general, and then second, the particular case of blessings. So we have clear indications that some people's prayers are more effective than other people's prayers in certain times and places. So for instance, James chapter 5, verse 16 says to confess our sins to one another, that we may be healed. And then it says the prayer of a righteous man has great power in its effects, or some translations say the prayer of a righteous man is efficacious. But notice that the word righteous is there, that it actually matters that you're in right relationship with God. And Hebrews talks about this in Hebrews 5, talks about how Jesus's prayers were heard because of his godly fear, which is really kind of striking. And on the flip side, in the Psalms, in Psalm 66, the psalmist says, if I had cherished iniquity in my heart, the Lord would not have listened. So if you're not right with God, and you're not trying to get right with God, then your prayers aren't going to be heard. That's different than, you know, a sinner who cries out for mercy. But someone who's living in sin and is just saying, oh, Lord, please give me this thing that I want, they're not in a place to make that request. And so it seems that even within the realm of those who are in right relationship with God, some people's prayers are more powerful than others. So to give a few examples, in Genesis, you have Abraham and Lot. And Lot is righteous, and he's saved from the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. But he's saved not because of his own righteousness, but because of Abraham's intercession for him. And we're told explicitly that God looks at the faith of Abraham and saves Lot. And that's different. You know, this is not a case of good versus bad. This is a case of good versus better. And then you've got the end of the book of Job. Job's got these three or four friends who are kind of theological know-it-alls. And they give him a lot of bad advice, and God punishes them and tells them that they won't be forgiven until Job prays for them, because God will accept his prayer. So this is Job 42, verses 7 to 10. And so sure enough, Job prays for them. God accepts Job's prayer, not the prayer of the friends. So all of that's to say that there clearly is a degree in which some people are in a position that their prayers are really efficacious. And so this is one of the reasons the early Christians point to in terms of why we pray to the saints, because these are people who are in the presence of God. And so we know that their prayers will be heard. And that's not to say we don't also go to God. Just like when I ask my neighbor to pray for me, it doesn't mean I don't also go to God directly. We do both. It's both end. But that's kind of the theology behind it. Now, tack on to that what Hebrews 7 talks about in terms of blessings, which is that a blessing, it says Hebrews 7, verse 7, it is beyond dispute that the inferior is blessed by the superior. That's the notion of like a father or a mother blessing children. That if someone's been placed in your care, you have a special privilege and power to bestow blessings upon them. And so you see, this is why, you know, the priest blesses the congregation, the Pope gives blessings at the Wednesday audience. This is also why I really encourage parents to do the sign of the cross and bless their children. In fact, if you go on the USCCB's website, or if you just Google USCCB parents prayers for children, they have a series of very short prayers you can say for your kids in blessing them. And so it's a really powerful thing, and that's what it's built on. So there's those two kind of dimensions. One, what's your relationship with God like? And two, what's your relationship with for the person that you're praying for?
What do you think, Patrick?
Okay. All right. Yeah, that makes sense. I guess the way it was explained to me is that it was more generalized than that. And it was like, father's prayers are 90% effective and mom's prayers are 70% effective.
Yeah, I wouldn't.
Wow.
But
mom's 20% less than dad?
I'm a little dubious of that one in particular. But yeah, anytime you're trying to reduce it to some kind of quantitative thing, I'm also skeptical of that. You know, could we say what percentage Lot's prayers were worth compared to Abraham's? Of course not. And I think any attempt to do so quickly runs into a kind of weird spiritual legalism. But nevertheless, we want to take seriously the idea that some people are closer to God and some people are closer to the problem. And people who are in a particular situation, you know, the Lord hears the cry of the poor. There's an idea that when you're really crying out from the midst, when you're really leaning on the Lord, he rewards that. And when you're taking care of your neighbor, when you're taking care of those to whom like you've been entrusted, God really looks favorably upon all of that. We should take that all seriously.
Thank you, Patrick. Thanks very much for the call. It's open forum. Lots of folks on the line today. Maybe one line open now, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Let's go to West Virginia now. Jeannie's in West Virginia, also listening on the app. It's a 100% app show so far today. Jeannie, go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hi, guys. Nice to talk with you both.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. I love West Virginia. Just saying that out loud.
Oh, you know what? Joe and I were recently talking about how much we love West Virginia.
Yes,
that is a magnificent.
Yes, I heard all about it. It's fine.
Oh, you did.
Thanks for still calling in.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I'm a transplant, but I've lived here most of my life, and I have a good sense of humor. It is fine. I can't take any offense from any of you all.
Oh, thank you, Gene.
Thanks.
Well, of course. So I have an Adam and Eve kind of question. So if God is so forgiving, well, I say if, we know he is, as such a forgiving God, why couldn't he just forgive Adam and Eve, or were they just not remorseful? Or, and even if, you know, say the answer is no, they weren't, and, how do I not be resentful that, you know, I'm held accountable and all the rest of us for all eternity are punished by the sins of basically two people? It's kind of like the group punishment in the class. You know, somebody did something, but the whole class gets punished. And I don't want to be resentful to God, but sometimes I feel a little resentful.
Yeah, no, I'm really glad.
Fair enough.
I think there's a few things. One, we should probably be aware of our own biases here as modern Western Christians, and I think especially as Americans, that we can be kind of radically individualistic in a way that actually doesn't make a ton of sense historically, and probably doesn't even make a ton of sense morally. Now, there is a sense, of course, in which you don't want the son to pay for his father's sins, but there is another sense in which if your parents do something really wonderful or really horrible, you can share in that honor or that dishonor in some way. And this is something that's just part of our relationality as humans, that we are not just these radical individuals. We belong to families, we belong to tribes, we belong to peoples. And so, you know, if your country 100 years ago did something wrong, they may have to pay reparations or make amends. You know, those kind of things can happen. And it's not about the individuals here and now necessarily being any kind of personally morally responsible, but a sort of collective guilt that can happen. That's one thing to just keep in mind. There's a lot of debated kind of territory with all of that, so you don't want to push that too far, because you want to recognize some sense of that while still preserving the fact that you don't want to punish people who are innocent, for the sins of the guilty. The second thing to remember is that what Adam and Eve experienced in the garden are what are known as the preternatural gifts. These are supernatural gifts, in other words. And these aren't things that are owed to us. These aren't things that belong to us by nature. And all of this is just gratuitous gifts from God. And the only string attached is that they not eat of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And of course, they break the one rule. And so those preternatural gifts are taken away from them. And so now we're born with concupiscence, an original sin. But this is not something we were not owed original integrity. We were not owed the supernatural gifts that are given to Adam and Eve. And so in that sense, it's not that God has done us any kind of injustice. Life is still a tremendous gift, even with all of the suffering, even with all the weakness, even with our own fallenness. Despite all of that, we've not been deprived of anything that was our right. But the third thing is that God really does forgive them right away, or rather, he provides the means for their reconciliation in a more superabundant sort of way. So in Genesis chapter 3, he puts the curse on Adam, Eve, and the serpent. And when he gets to the serpent, he tells the serpent that he'll be put at enmity, meaning strife, with the woman. And the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman would be at war as well. Now, that's really striking because the seed is almost always measured through the man. And even the Hebrew word zera for seed, it's a male kind of contribution to the process. And so what we have here is the first prediction of the virgin birth. The reason it says the seed of the woman instead of the seed of the man is that the woman in question isn't just Eve. The woman in question is Mary. And because there's no biological father of Jesus, we can't talk about the seed of the man because there is no man providing seed when it comes to the remedy here. And so when we're told the seed shall crush the head of Satan, this is a prophecy that Mary and Jesus are going to come in the first century, that there will be a new woman and that she will have a child. And so the means of redemption are provided right here, just a couple verses after the fall. And so Aquinas talks about this, like, why does God wait this long instead of just saying, hey, don't worry, forget about it. And he offers several reasons. Now, with all of these, we're speculating. But one of my favorite reasons that he offers is that God, basically, he allowed us to screw up, and then he brings about salvation of us through us. Meaning, he could have just snapped his finger and said, you owed me the debt, I forgive the debt, don't sweat it, you guys are idiots. But that would have been kind of demeaning to the human condition. It would just treat us as so irreparably beyond hope that we couldn't be part of the actual process of cleanup. But instead, the word becomes flesh. Jesus takes on humanity. And as someone who's both fully God and fully man, he brings about the salvation of the world so that all of the demerits of Adam and Eve, but also of every one of us in every generation ever since, all of those are outweighed by the merits of a human being, a divine being with a human nature. Jesus Christ, who's truly man. And like because of that, like we are part of the story of redemption. We're not just part of the problem, we're part of the solution. And so just as we share in the common disgrace of Adam and Eve, we now share in the common glory of Jesus Christ, our brother.
Jeannie, what do you think?
I feel like I'm in that commercial about Twizzlers. I'm going to have to chew on that one.
I don't know this commercial, but I like that line.
Yeah. Oh, now I'm hungry, Jeannie.
Yeah,
all right.
Sorry. No. That was really deep and compelling, and I'm going to definitely re-listen to that in the podcast. But I think I received what you were saying, and basically to summarize, I think what I got from that is he might have forgiven them, but it still needed to play out the way it did so that we can, have Jesus come and do what he did and we can take part in, like, the mop-up of all the mess. And that, the way generations before you kind of set you up for where you are is how we all had to get involved and caught up in their sin. It's just like the way everything else has been handed down through your family line. It's just kind of part of your lineage that we picked that up. Is that about right?
Yeah. So, real quick question. Jeannie, do you have any kids?
Yeah, one. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, I know this. I've got, toddlers. And when they make a mess, it is so much easier for me just to clean it up myself. But it's so much more important to actually cooperate with them in the cleanup process. Mm-hmm. And that's what God does with us. He patiently waits to let us cooperate in the cleanup process. And that's the mystery of the incarnation. And that's also the mystery of how we participate in redemption. He could just snap his fingers and say, faith doesn't matter. Cooperation with faith doesn't matter. None of that matters. Everybody goes to heaven. No sweat. He doesn't do that because he does something that actually is greater dignity for human beings.
Jeannie, thank you very much for the call and for the Twizzler reference. We got to take a very quick break. It's open forum. There's one line open, 888-318-7884. If you have a question about the Catholic faith, we'd love to talk with you. Right back with more on Catholic Answers Live. When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to casociety315.com and join today.
Is relativism dead? It sure seems dead. Each day, new moral demands are made and they are presented to us as absolutes. Everything from transgender ideology to physician-assisted suicide is presented as a moral good that all right-thinking people must accept. But Catholic Answers' own Carla Broussard says look deeper, and you will see today's moralism is just relativism dressed up in new clothes. Carla's eye-opening book, The New Relativism, shines a light on how the sacred moral teachings of this age cover up a deep denial of moral truth. Order your copy of The New Relativism today at shop.catholic.com and be prepared to defend the truth against aggressive relativism. The New Relativism at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
This is Dr. David Anders. Is God an angry God?
We answer questions like these every day on Call to Communion, tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern.
Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's open forum both hours today. Our guest is Joe Heschmeyer, and your call is welcome at 888-31-TRUTH. If you're looking for a great book to read during this big Eucharistic revival that we're all praying for, and that really, I have not met a single Catholic who's not all on board with a revival of love for and understanding of the Eucharist. If you want a great book for that, pick up your copy of Joe's book, The Eucharist is Really Jesus, at shop.catholic.com. And here's the deal. You save 33%. You get a third off when you enter the promo code Jesus33 at checkout. Get yours today at shop.catholic.com. I'm going to go now to Bella in South Bend, Indiana, watching on Facebook. Bella, are you there with us?
Yes.
Well, hello, Bella. How old are you?
Six.
Six. Well, thank you very much for calling. We're very happy to have you. Go ahead with your question for Mr. Heschmeyer.
How many saints are in the world?
How many saints in the world?
Yeah, how many saints, Joe?
That's a great question, Bella. Beautiful name. I've got a daughter named Stella. So that's a really good question, and no one knows the answer to that question. So very good job. You've stumped me. We are about 10,000 or 11,000 canonized saints. But we know from the Bible that there are many, many more people who are saints who've never been officially declared saints by the church. So in the last book of the Bible, the book of Revelation, in chapter 7, St. John sees 144,000 people in heaven. But then he says, after this I looked, and behold, a great multitude which no man could number from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and tongues, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes with palm branches in their hands and crying out with a loud voice, salvation belongs to our God who sits upon the throne and to the Lamb. And so that gives us a lot of hope. We don't know how many saints there are, but there are a lot. There are more than we can count. And so that's something that we look forward to, sharing in their joy in heaven. It's something we're really striving for. What do you think of that, Bella?
Cool.
Okay. Bella, you're really cool. You did a really good job on the phone. So congratulations. Thanks for a very nice call. Can we send her a book? Oh, sure. We can send her a book. You know what? Let's send her The Truth Is Out There. We have a book that's a, it's not a comic book. It's a graphic novel. And it's called The Truth Is Out There. And Bella, I think I heard your mom there with you. If she is, just put her on the phone and we'll get an address where she would like us to send your book. Thank you, Bella. Thank you very, very much. From Bella to TikTok. I don't even know how to make that transition. But Thomas, the TikTok engine, is here with a question from TikTok. Thomas, welcome.
Hi, Si. Nice to be here talking with all of you, even if I'm the only one in the room right now.
I know. Well,
it's a little quiet in here.
It's called the magic of radio, Thomas.
It is. Or the internet, where I have to spend a lot of my time. There's some magic there.
If you don't know about that, ask Mr. Topham Hatt. He will help you with it.
Mr. Topham.
This is a Thomas the Tank Engine joke for those of you who may not have small children.
Thanks, Joe.
Thomas the Tank Engine's for everybody.
That's true.
Thomas, the TikTok engine, go ahead with your question.
All right, Joe. This person on TikTok, they had a pretty simple request. They just wanted us to make a video about papal supremacy in the early church.
Yeah, it's a good question. So papal supremacy could mean a lot of things, depending on the person who's using the term. We want to avoid a kind of caricature where it means the Pope settles every dispute every time it happens. We don't even see the apostles acting like that. That's just not a healthy kind of managerial style, not a healthy leadership style, not a healthy vision of what fatherhood looks like. Instead, the way papal supremacy actually plays out is that in the early church, when there are disputes, people can reach out to the Church of Rome and the Pope can settle disputes kind of upon request and when situations bubble over. He's not usually the first line of defense, but if you imagine something a little bit like the Supreme Court. And we see this from very early on. In the first letter of St. Clement, around 96 AD, you find the Christians in Corinth are having a problem once again. Anyone who knows their Bible knows this is not unprecedented. And they reach out to Pope Clement. And he replies, and he begins his reply by apologizing that it's taken a while to answer owing to the calamity. They're under persecution, and so he hasn't been able to put this at the top of the to-do list. And this is really remarkable because all of this is happening while the Apostle John is alive relatively close to Corinth on the Isle of Patmos. And so it shows a clear indication of a recognition in Corinth as well as in Rome of a special role the Pope has, that the Bishop of Rome really has this role in adjudicating things. And then you jump forward about 90 years to Against Heresies, and this is the book in which we first get Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John named explicitly as the four Gospels. And it's, as I always like to mention, written about a year before the first explicit mention of the Trinity in regards to the Godhead. In there, in Book 3, Chapter 3, St. Irenaeus talks about how he's going to trace every pope from Peter and Paul down to his own day, Pope Eleutherius, who's the 13th pope. And he explains that he's doing this because, in his words, quote, it is a matter of necessity that every church should agree with this church on account of its preeminent authority. So again, that doesn't mean that the church in Rome has to micromanage governance in every local church. And in fact, I would argue the church in Rome shouldn't do that, particularly when you have churches of different liturgical rites. there's a healthy sense of, you know, leaving well enough alone and not being overbearing in your leadership style. But in terms of the authority that we both see it in action in First Clement, and we see it mentioned directly in Against Heresies. And there's a bunch more examples after this of just seeing the Church of Rome in action.
Yeah, the early church really did need a place where the buck stopped, right, if it got far enough up the ladder.
Yeah, St. Optatus of Milevis in his Against the Donatists talks about this, how there's one cathedra on which the successor of Peter sits. And the reason for this is that if there were separate ones, then the apostolic church would be immediately divided. And it really is remarkable when you compare early Christianity to, say, early Islam, where you have the Sunni-Shiite split immediately, or even something like early Mormonism, where you have the split between the LDS and the RLDS and the Beckerites and everything immediately upon the death of Joseph Smith. And so there is no succession crisis in early Christianity because of this role of the See of Peter in Rome.
Great. Thanks so much, Joe.
Thank you, Thomas, the TikTok engines. Please say hello to Mrs. TikTok engine for us.
If she's not watching right now, I'll say hi to her later.
All right. Joe, before I go to the next call, what do Ringo Starr, Alec Baldwin?
All on Thomas the Tank Engine.
They were all the, but who's the third one?
Oh, they were all the voice of the narrator.
They all narrated Thomas the Tank Engine. Yeah.
And George Carlin, right?
George Carlin, yeah, right. For me, Ringo Starr is the real deal, but they all did a good job. Brent,
not a lot of praise for George Carlin on Catholic shows typically. So this is
no, he was
one of those rare areas where he was.
He wasn't a big supporter of ours, so we don't really generally praise him. But he did a very fine job on Thomas the Tank Engine, and he taught me things that I'm not allowed to say on the radio. Brent is in Ontario, Canada, listening to EWTN on Channel 130 Sirius XM satellite radio. Brent, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Yes, very nice to speak to you both. Love your podcast, Joe, and I had a question about, I really enjoy the Mormonism stuff. I didn't know anything really about them. So I was wondering if the Mormons, when they speak of the great apostasy, do they believe that Christians, they died out until Joseph Smith's prophecy, or were they underground and hiding? And if they teach that they were hiding, do they believe that there just are no writings from Christians for 1,800 years? Can you help me out?
Yeah, very, very good question. So, no, the lot of you that you're describing about them kind of just going into hiding is more common among certain Baptists. And this is not even a mainstream view of it, I think, within Baptist theology, but sometimes called Baptist successionism, the notion that there have always been Baptists for 2,000 years and we just don't have written records of the first, 1,600 years of them. That, I think, is a reasonably fringe view. There's a book called Trail of Blood that argues that. But that's Baptist. That's not the Mormon view. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints argues that almost immediately after the death of the apostles in, the first century, you have the destruction of Orthodox Christianity. And so you have the loss of the priesthood authority and you have a loss of prophetic ministry. And that those are the two things specifically. So you still have people who are trying to follow Jesus, but there's a mixture of error. And then this happens because they believe that Christianity also existed in the Americas. This happens about 300 or 400 years later in the Americas. And then after this, Joseph Smith, in what's called the First Vision, he has a vision, he says, of seeing the Father and the Son. And I believe it's in that vision where they tell him all the Christian creeds are abominations. And so there is a clear sense in which it's not that there is some group of devout Mormons who are somewhere out there in the woods and we just don't know about them. There's a belief in what's called the Restoration, that Joseph Smith is an inspired prophet. He is given these golden tablets and given the spiritual insight to translate them. And these are an ancient record of the doings of the new world. And then he is given priestly authority by John the Baptist, and he's able to kind of restore the Church of Christ.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Right, well, thanks for listening to the podcast. I'm really happy to hear you say that.
I wish you could do more.
Oh, he's expecting his third kid.
Yeah, I know.
He's going to have plenty of you. It's actually way less work for me than it is for my wife in terms of.
I've been thinking about Anna because it's hot where you are, and she is not in the first trimester. It's hard to be pregnant late in summer.
She's very pregnant. Our air conditioner is really struggling to keep up with how hot it is. Aww. It hasn't gotten below 80. Even in the middle of the night for like the past 4 or 5 days, it has been the hottest it's been on record. And so, yeah, God has decided that mortification is going to be good for us.
I guess so. Thanks, Brent. Hey, if you want to listen to Joe's podcast, you can go to shamelessjoe.com. His podcast is called Shameless Popery, and it really is growing in popularity. And we're getting more and more questions here about the things Joe says there. So check it out, shamelessjoe.com. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
By providing quality programming faithful to the teachings of the Catholic Church, EWTN Television is TV that viewers can trust. Whether it's films, documentaries, news coverage, lively discussion shows, or kids programs, we highlight the truth that is the eternal word. For a complete schedule of EWTN television programs, visit EWTN.com and click TV. EWTN is the global Catholic network.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kelliger, your host. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest, and it is Open Forum. And let me look and see if there's a line open. 888-318-7884. You can anybody can call. You most certainly do not have to be Catholic. There are lots of folks who would like to ask about something having to do with the Christian faith from a Catholic perspective. And whatever perspective you're coming from, you're very welcome here. Philip is in Massachusetts watching on YouTube. Philip, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hi there. So I'm a Neoplatonist, so I'm pretty accepting of other religions, including Christianity. I saw your YouTube short about what makes Jesus unique, and it's that he is the only God or religious incarnation where God comes down to our level to be with us. But I can think of other examples in traditional pre-Christian faiths. I think, you know, Buddha takes on the world's suffering to discover enlightenment. Krishna claims to be an incarnation of divine love itself. And even Socrates, to some extent, in my own tradition, is viewed as something of a divine figure bridging divinity and humankind. But given these examples in pre-Christian history, what would be the Catholic response to all of this with regard to the uniqueness of Jesus? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, very good question. So two things. Number one, at least with the case of the Buddha, Siddhartha, he is very clearly a human who achieves enlightenment. Even, you know, Buddha means like the awakened or the enlightened one. And so, you know, and he's under the Bodhi tree. And then he has this kind of realization, you know, that everything is suffering or, you know, dukkha. This is very much man going upwards rather than God coming down. And Socrates' self-description, you know, in the Apology and elsewhere, where, you know, he seems to be guided in some sense by the oracle who only tells him what not to believe. He doesn't claim to be a divine figure stepping into the world. So those would be the first cases. Like the actual historical figures we have are clearly men, don't claim to be anything more than men, who may be enlightened men, who may have an insight into the nature of reality, but it still is that upward movement of man reaching out to God or man reaching out to the cosmos, man reaching out to the nature of reality, which is all good and true, you know, and, I mean, as long as it's right. I'm not knocking any of that in principle. I am saying it is different than Christianity, in which gone enters the world and comes down. Now, you're right that you have mythological stuff like that. You know, Zeus enters the world. But you don't have that as an actual historical event. So you can find plenty of kind of once upon a time stories. I think Krishna would fall into this. If you said, oh, on this date, Krishna came into the world, nobody actually traces historically Hinduism to, you know, someone who claimed to be Krishna walking around in the world. Rather, this is a story told centuries later, you know, in the Bhagavad Gita and other places about these kind of figures of long ago. So it puts them in a really different category. With Christianity, we have the founder of Christianity in the first century claiming to be and seeming to be God himself entering the world. And certainly from a Christian perspective, we would say this is what makes it radically different. Like, even if other religions include stories about how the gods walked among us, they aren't actually traceable historically to God walking among us in the way Christianity is. Does that distinction make sense?
Sure. I think it's a pretty good answer. So I'm not extremely ultra scholastically well-versed in the other religions that I don't necessarily practice. So I'll only speak on behalf of Socrates for the time being. I would make a distinction saying that Socrates does have a sort of Apollonian discipleship, sort of as someone who is called by Apollo or called by the Apollonian, you know, priestess to do what he does. It's even implied in some of the dialogues that he's incapable of error after that point, whenever he sees the oracle. Again, I wouldn't want to take away the uniqueness of Jesus because Socrates didn't die on a cross, but I think that the argument that God or divinity chooses to only meet man in Christianity is the argument I would tackle, not necessarily the full uniqueness of Jesus.
I would even say there's a sense in which we would agree with you that God reaches out to every man at the level of conscience and at the level of creation, for instance. And so even in that hunger with, you know, the so-called natural religion, this is in some part sparked by a divine action, that the stirring of God in the soul leads everyone on earth on some level to ask the kind of religious questions, you know, where do we come from? Where do we go? And all of those questions. And so in that sense, I think that's true. The answers to it. Now, I mean, this again is going to be a point where, you know, you can find these later accounts that apply to Socrates more than I think we find him claiming, even within kind of the first generation with, was it Xenophon and Plato, that it later it kind of the Socratic legend builds, if you will.
Sure thing. Okay, I appreciate the answer.
Yeah, thanks. That's a great question. We don't get that many Neoplatonists to call in. So
this is my first. You're my first Neoplatonist caller, Philip. Thank you very much.
Old Platonist calling in. Come on.
We don't even let the old Platonists on. Yeah. No, you got to be one of the Neos. Joe's got a couple of very, very fine books. Siobhan can tell you about them. But if you want one, I'd love to send you one. As you continue your studies, you might enjoy one of them. Maybe the early church was the Catholic Church, or his new book on the Eucharist. Just talk to Siobhan on the line, and she will set you up with the one you want. Brad's in Waco, Texas, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Brad, thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Thank you very much. My question is, how do we defend the church's infallibility in light of the letters written to the seven churches in the book of Revelation?
Well, are you saying because some of those churches die out?
Well, I'll be quite frank. This question was posed to me today, and I have not made time to read through the entire book to that portion.
Okay, so there's two things.
I'm sorry, please go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead. If you've got a clarification, I'm happy to take it.
No, I think you were just claiming that there are errors in the church at that point, and how can we say that the church is infallible if the church is making errors or the people in the church are making errors, which I assume it was.
Yeah, so these are seven local churches, some of which are doing better than others, and we're told some of them are doing well, some of them are not doing so well. There's corrections, there's encouragement, there's everything given to each of the seven local churches. And so we want to believe that. And this is important to remember as Catholics. We believe that the church collectively won't die out. The gates of hell will not overcome the church. The gates of hell might overcome me. the gates of hell might overcome the church in America. You know, for a long time, North Africa was a hotbed of Christianity. Look at it today, and it's not. I mean, Europe was on fire for the faith, and now it's struggling to survive. And so the fact that the church on earth won't be wiped out in a great apostasy doesn't mean that the church in a local area might not get wiped out. And so that's what I think we should really take from this, that we don't want to just rest comfortably and say, well, because the story works out well in the end, therefore, I don't need to worry about it. I don't need to do my part, because that would be a huge error.
Okay. I guess he was stating essentially that the church is infallible. The church is not infallible because of these issues. They wouldn't have had these issues there in the local churches.
No, I mean, local churches can and do struggle. Local Catholic churches struggle. There's nothing in infallibility that suggests anything otherwise. You know, in the same way, the cell on a body could die without the body dying. The church is the body of Christ, and it can still have cells of the body that die. And that's not contrary to the promise. But for the body of Christ to die, that's contrary to the promise.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you.
Yeah, you bet.
Brad, it sounds like it might be helpful to you have a copy of Joe's book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. If you'd like it, just hang on the line and we'll send it to you. We'd be happy to. I'm going to go to Claire in Louisiana listening on Christ Our King Radio. Claire, go ahead with your question for Joe.
Well, first of all, I want to tell you that I love your show. I love you, WTN. It has deepened my faith very much.
And praise God.
Tell it, you make me laugh all the time.
Now, wait, on purpose? A lot of times.
The cutest thing on the radio.
Oh, you're very nice, Claire. But usually people are laughing at me more than with me. So I appreciate that very, very much.
No. It's with you. I love your sense of humor.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, this is my question. We assume that Peter was married because he had a mother-in-law. So does that mean that our first pope was married?
We know he had been married at one point because he has a mother-in-law. It's really striking in the account of Jesus healing the mother-in-law. When she's healed, she gets up and starts taking care of the house. And it's actually kind of noticeable that we don't see his wife there. And so there's an open question as to whether Peter was a widower. And one of the reasons we think he might have actually been celibate, you know, meaning like a widower who didn't get remarried, is in Matthew 19. After Jesus talks about the high cost of discipleship, Peter says to him, "Lo, we have left everything and followed you. What then shall we have?" Which sounds like he's left even the prospect of family. And if it didn't sound like that enough in the question, it certainly sounds like that in Jesus's answer. He says, "Everyone who has left houses or brothers or sisters or father or mother or children or lands for my sake will receive 100-fold and inherit eternal life." So Jesus understands Peter's question to mean, we've given up family life. We've given up the normal married life we could have had for the sake of the gospel. And so we don't know for sure. The evidence is too scant to say 100%, but it doesn't look like Peter has a living wife at any point in the gospel. We never hear about her or any of the wives of any of the 12, which is pretty remarkable if there were these women going around. We hear about other faithful women. We don't hear about Peter's wife. You know, what was her name? Who was she? When, you know, none of that stuff. We hear about the mother-in-law. We don't hear about a living wife. So it's, like I said, it's not 100% clear, but I think the biblical evidence points to him not having a wife at the time. Then the last thing I'd say is, remember that celibacy of priests is something that is encouraged in the Bible. Eunuchs for the kingdom, Jesus talks about in Matthew 19 as well. And in 1 Corinthians, St. Paul talks about his celibacy being really good. It is not a divine commandment. So there are and always have been some married priests.
Oh, I wanted to talk with Claire more. Claire, thank you very, very much for the call and for the kind comments. How about we give Claire a copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church
let's do it.
As well. And that'll do it for us for this hour. But Joe, you're coming back for another hour, yes?
I sure am.
All right. Then we will return shortly with more Open Forum. If you're on the line, stay on the line. If you haven't dialed yet, you're very welcome here, 888-318-7884.